Welcome to A Handful of Dust. This is a podcast all about Neil Gaiman's The Sandman comic, which we are running through our ideas and themes that come to us as we reread the series. I'm Eamon.
And I'm Jenny. And as always, we start with a content note. Some of the comics deal with some dark and troubling subject matters, and we might refer to them or discuss them in depth in these episodes. So for more information about the topics in the books and in this podcast, you can see the show notes for more information.
As ever, if you want time codes, email us at the email that's in the show notes. Housekeeping notes, I don't think I've got any this time. We're going to be doing that at the end of this episode, I think, Jen. So, Volume 10, this is The Wake, the last six issues of The Sandman, issues 70 to 75. Art is by Michael Zulli, John J. Muth and Charles Vess. And I've divided it in our outline into two distinct halves.
Yeah.
We've got the first three issues of this, which are all about basically Dream's funeral, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And we get to the sort of run-up to the funeral, we get the funeral itself, then we get some of the aftermath of the funeral. And it gives Neil Gaiman, and indeed us, a chance to catch up with loads of characters from the entirety of the run. We get almost direct-to-camera pieces by Calliope, Thessaly. Finally, I think it's absolutely confirmed that her and Dream had a thing at the start of Brief Lives. We even get Titania, who refuses to say much about it, but clearly was swooning over Dream as well. What did you make of all the different characters turning up and getting to do their little spiel?
I liked it. I think we've talked before about how Neil Gaiman doesn't let any character disappear. He uses every part of the buffalo in a way. And so it was good to see some of these characters come back and to sort of like fill out that world building that has obviously been like bubbling behind the scenes. And we've only got to see like a little bit of things as stuff has got, like as the story's been going on, we've got little hints of stuff. And I think Neil Gaiman took this opportunity to really flex and bring us like backstories and things. So yeah, I did enjoy moments of it. It did maybe feel a little bit self-indulgent at places, I think.
I don't know if you noticed, but Neil Gaiman himself appears to be in the crowd at one point.
I didn't notice that, but maybe that's the ultimate.
Yeah.
The ultimate moment. I took issue with maybe some of the focus on some of the characters.
Yes, I did as well. We'll come to that in just a moment, yeah.
Yeah, we talked in the last episode about when I hadn't quite got to The Wake yet and I was trying to remember what the connection with, like, Lita Hall was in this book. And I feel like she was sort of underused in this one, whereas, you know, we get, like, a full... We get a lot from Thessaly and a substantial amount from Calliope. And I think for Thessaly gives us new information and Titania's hints at new information. But the Calliope section, I think we kind of had all that information already.
From the Song of Orpheus.
Yeah. And it gives a little bit more depth, but we also don't, you know, we never hear from the mysterious, is it Alianora, who is in Game of You.
But she appears to speak at the funeral. We see her, but we don't hear her words.
We don't get like a sort of, we don't really find out any more about her.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, she's been hinted at a lot throughout the piece. And so, yeah, I don't know. I feel like there were some nice moments, but I felt like there was almost too many moments. And like, it was a bit like of an overload almost.
Let's get a little bit of fun out of the way and just mention that there are some DC comic character callbacks here. In particular, we see Superman, Batman and the Martian Manhunter in the dream together talking. Interestingly, Superman in a dream appears as Clark Kent, whereas Batman in the dream is really bat-like, isn't he? He's even more bat-like than he is in the comics. And we also get some of the Trenchcoat Brigade, as they're known, John Constantine. There you are, Conrad. Dr. Occult and the Phantom Stranger appear. So a little, you know, just one little panel notes to some DC stuff, which I obviously, as a DC nerd, I quite liked all that. For you, it was probably, oh yeah, just throwing some of the superheroes along the way.
Well, I did. I definitely had a moment where I recognised John Constantine, but, like, didn't know who the other two were. And I was like, I'm sure that's a reference. I was trying to, like, frantically remember if they'd come up before or, like, I was missing something. So, as always, it's nice to hear that these are references and they're just going over my head.
In the Books of Magic, written by Neil Gaiman about the DC boy wizard Tim Hunter, part of his education is by the Trenchcoat Brigade, who are a sort of loose collection of DC sort of occult investigator type characters.
I see.
And of course, Tim Hunter goes on to be part of the Children's Crusade with the Dead Boy Detectives.
Oh.
There is a connection there.
That makes sense.
Can I ask you about two characters from the comic book? One who's at the funeral and one who's not at the funeral.
Yes.
Did you want to know any more or hear any more from Richard Madoc from the Calliope story in Dream Country?
I absolutely did not.
Me neither.
I think that was a poor choice to include him. I think we understood from the inclusion of Alex Burgess, who turns up in his, like, child form.
Yes.
That there is a sort of implication that now Dream Morpheus is dead, that his sort of his actions have sort of been undone in a way. So, yeah. Like, Alex Burgess has woken up from his waking nightmare. And I think this is to confirm that Richard Madoc, who's been given this, he's given the gift of too many ideas, isn't he? Too many dreams.
Too many stories.
The monkey's paw gift.
Yes.
Of too many ideas at the end of the Calliope story. And so I guess we're supposed to understand that he has lost that as well. Yeah, I didn't need to see him again. I definitely didn't need to see him being removed from his punishment, shall we say. And I think the last moment we see, the last panel we see him is him smiling, sitting in a deck chair or something.
I got the feeling that Neil Gaiman has some, you know, has some interest in Richard Madoc. He has some sympathies for this terrible character that we disliked intensely. You know, the writer with terrible writer's block. There's that line in this one where he says, you know, Richard Madoc realises that for the first time in ages he's put together a set of words in an order that nobody has done before. And you're probably right. Morpheus, as part of the funeral arrangements, there seems to be a bit of an amnesty, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, like Alex Burgess is given back, gets back to life. There's a scene that we might talk about between Leta Hall and the new Dream Lord. So I suppose Richard Madoc is included in that amnesty, but I didn't really want to see him there. I certainly didn't want to hear from him.
Yeah, and I think it's actually, you know, we've just mentioned that Calliope is supposedly at this funeral as well. And so, you know, we never get to see her opinion of him being there, which maybe not would not be favourable, despite, I think there is a mention that there are a billion people there. But still, you know, there's like, why the choice to bring him back and have this scene of him being slightly absolved? And I think, there's a connection to Neil Gaiman, maybe the writer. I think there's even a hint that Rose in The Kindly Ones, Rose is reading a book by Richard Madoc as well.
And she was reading the book, the guy before Richard Madoc.
Oh, the guy
before, Erasmus
Fry
book, yes.
The original Calliope abuser.
Yes.
And I did wonder in The Kindly Ones, we didn't talk about it, but I did wonder why that connection, other than Rose being able to like connect all these people up, like why Neil Gaiman chose to put that little reference in. And I wonder if he was signalling, trying to like jog our memories so that in the Wake issues, we would remember who Richard Madoc is. Yeah, I didn't think it was necessary. I definitely felt like it's kind of doesn't really connect with my understanding of how these characters were portrayed in the book. You know, I don't think Richard Madoc was a particularly complex character for me. Like, I don't think his actions were, or rather, I don't think there was much grey area, shall we say, with his actions. I think his actions were undeniably evil. And so to have this sort of like, he gets his moment at the end seemed a bit gross, but maybe is also representative of how men who are proven to be abusers end up being absolved in some way or forgiven in some way is maybe true to life, but maybe not the fantasy I want to live with.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't be a handful of dust if we didn't find some problematical characters and moments in it. Yes. All right, so you mentioned Rose Walker. Rose Walker and her brother Jed are at the funeral, and they get a nice moment where she tells him in the dream that she's pregnant, and he gets to say something nice about families, that families are cool. And she says, aren't you the one who said families suck? And he says, yeah, they do both. They suck and they're cool, or something like that. Or they suck and they rule. Which I thought was a nice brother-sister moment. We've seen some nice brother-sister moments, and Rose and Jed have one at the funeral, which I liked.
And even like the little line of the sort of connecting up this little web between them and Lita Hall as well, where Jed's just like, she lived in my head.
Yes.
It's just like a little bit of nice dream logic, which is kind of what the whole thing is about, really.
Yeah. What about characters that we don't see at the funeral? Were there any characters from the run that you particularly thought maybe they should have been there, or maybe there's a reason why they're not there?
I wondered if we were going to see any characters who had died during the run. And it's sort of not really clear if there is a line.
Emperor Norton the First is there.
Yeah. See, that's why I was sort of thinking, like, is it people who've died and then become part of the dreaming distinctly, or is it sort of like, you know, it would have been nice to see some of these characters who we've lost along the way, and I think it's crucial that we don't see Nada at any point.
Don't we see the little boy, though?
Do we?
We do, yes. The little boy, the little Hong Kong-born boy is at funeral.
Oh yeah, I forgot and about that connection.
He scatters, I think he scatters rose petals or something on the water as the boat takes the body away.
You are right. I had completely forgotten that Nada is reborn at the end of Seasons of Mist, being like, why does this happen? And now it's like, oh, that's why that happened.
Okay, but yeah, so dead characters can be there possibly. Reborn characters like Nada can turn up. Talking about characters who are lost, where's Barbie?
Where is Barbie?
Is Barbie lost to the dreaming after the events of A Game of You, do you think?
I think it's possible. We've obviously, when we talked about Game of You, we talked about the ending and how that wraps up. And I can't remember if there's an implication that she's stopped dreaming again.
All we know about her is that she's going to go out and do nothing. You know, yeah. She's going to travel America and do nothing. Is what she said, and we haven't seen her since. And again, if anybody has seen a appearance of Barbie in other DC dreaming comic books, please get in touch and let us know.
I mean, maybe I wondered, as the characters are sort of being collected up at the beginning, and we see Noala and Alex and Richard and a few others fall asleep and wake up at the funeral, I wondered whether there was, you know, you had to be willing to go to the funeral, you know. And I wondered if actually after Barbie's confrontation, or even invited, shall we say, after, like, because Barbie has a confrontation with Dream at the end, and she's one of those people who tells him what to do and fixes the things that he can't be bothered to fix. I wonder if she didn't want to.
Yeah, maybe.
She didn't have any unfinished business like the rest of them, because she sort of finished hers.
I hope she's out there in America still, travelling, having a good time, remembering Wanda, and I hope she's all right. There you are.
Yes, I think that's good.
Well, I mean, obviously at the funeral, there are the Endless themselves, memorably joked about by Matthew the Raven when he talks about you must be Delirium, Destiny, and Dog. So a nice little D word joke gets in there. Endless, they've got, obviously there's a ritual. The ritual involves the cerements from the Necropolis city. We've seen that in World's End. They have to create a sort of emissary character who goes into the, what would you call them, the basements or the cellars in order to get the cerements. Then there's the funeral itself. They speak at the funeral. Were you interested in what the Endless were up to during this process, or were you more interested in the sort of supporting cast characters?
I felt like the beginning where we're at the city of Necropolis was a bit unnecessary because we'd already sort of had that moment in World's End.
Yeah.
I think it was interesting because we see them, we also get sort of, we get a little bit more world building in the sense that we learn a little bit more about Despair's former self and the fact that they haven't done, this is like the second time they've had to do this as a family. And so I did like that we got to know a little bit more about Despair, and obviously I like any time that Delirium shows up, and I think she's kind of the standout here as
she
well.
She is, isn't she? She was my standout of the speakers at the funeral. She only gets one page, which is dominated by one sort of panel of her. She's been supported and encouraged by Barnabas the dog. And what she says is, well, she's got her party dress on, hasn't she? And her wings, which I loved.
Yeah.
Torn fishnets, of course. He was my big brother. I was always a bit scared of him, but I'm not anymore. I'm a bit sad of him. And that's okay. Or no, that's all she says. And I love how the sort of funeral flowers behind her have turned into butterflies and flamingos and a little octopus. So she gets a great moment, doesn't she?
She does. And I think, you know, we've talked before about how she has the ability to, like, say just the right thing. And I think that's a very good example of it.
She definitely cuts through it, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Matthew the Raven, as always, is quite fun. It's a good time when he talks, as you say.
And I really think that these issues are quite concerned with Matthew. And he's the one who sort of, you know, in the kindly ones, we talked about him questioning the rules and questioning what was going on. And here we see him sort of, again, questioning and not quite being able to get his head around the sort of like double dream lord, one who's dead and one who's, but he's back and but it's different. And so I quite enjoyed Matthew's sort of little interludes here and there where he's sort of figuring stuff out and making his decision.
And Daniel, the new dream lord, is sort of recreating some of the dreams who were destroyed in the fight with the kindly ones. So he rebuilds Merv Pumpkinhead. And Matthew has a real problem saying, but you're not Merv Pumpkinhead. Merv Pumpkinhead was a friend of mine. You're not him. And yeah. He has a slight problem with the whole process. And he can't, as you say, quite get his head round the new Dream Lord and whether he's going to stay on as his Raven or not. So he goes through quite a process in these three issues, which is, as you say, it's good stuff, isn't it?
And I think it's really like what's... Matthew almost becomes the, like, reader insert in a way that, like, Matthew is the one who's like is aware of the dreaming but is also aware of like a human reality, and so is able to like move between those two and sort of question things and point out the like this doesn't make sense, and you know, then have someone be like it doesn't have to make sense, you know. Kind of thing. And you know, I think some of his interactions with the former dream were like the most interesting moments. And here it seems like his moments with Daniel, the new dream, will also be some of the most interesting moments, you know?
Mm. I should know if Matthew is still the Raven in the dreaming. I know, as we sort of record in the comic, that the Dream Lord has gone, he's gone walkabout in the comic at the moment.
I see. So
I think Matthew, if I remember rightly, Matthew is still in that comic at the moment. But anyway, yeah. Okay, so it's a lovely moments with Matthew. The Endless are going through the rituals. We get all the supporting characters turn up. In fact, in these three issues, we sort of get just about everybody we've come to know and like or detest turns up for their panel or two, don't they? You know, the dreaming gets recreated. We get a moment with the guardians of the gate. We get Destruction turns up. They're all there, aren't they?
Yeah, everyone comes in and says a piece and moves on and gets their storyline tied up or gets hints at their future storyline. So I think, you know, we've mentioned like Delirium and Matthew and maybe even Rose and Lita being like the ones we wanted to see. And I feel like everyone who had a favourite would be happy about, like, even if they only get like a panel of a glimpse at someone, would be happy to see their favourite characters come in.
Okay. Any of the other thoughts or notes about the first three issues at all, Jen?
I mean, one thing I did want to touch on a little bit, and I'm not sure really what I have to say, but we were talking about Lita Hall in The Kindly Ones and whether she gets a proper moment with Daniel. And so, yes. Like, she does get a scene with Daniel, a very short scene. And mainly what this does is to, like, remove the threat from her, right? Like, she no longer has to run.
He takes the threat off her. He puts he said, "My mark is upon you. No one will harm you."
So she has, like, a future ahead of her that isn't running away. But we also have seen her refer to, like, Carla in the book, and she still doesn't know what's happened to Carla. So there's an indication that she still has another funeral to attend, shall we say. And, like, there are things in her life that are not perfect. And as I say, like, she gets a bit of dream logic of, like, Daniel's not dead, this is Daniel, but this isn't Daniel anymore, kind of thing. And as we talked about in the last episode, I'm never happy about these things. And I don't think she gets the ending that I would have hoped that she gets, you know?
No, she doesn't get the resolution. She doesn't get even her moment of mourning. She doesn't, as we said last time, there's no moment by a graveside for Carla and baby Daniel. Baby Daniel, like Amy Pond's baby, has just sort of, like, blink, gone.
Has because transcended into a completely different character.
Yes, exactly. For story needs, has grown up quickly into another character altogether.
And I think we've talked a bit in the part, I mean, we mentioned Barbie's ending where she gets to sort of say what she's going to do and decide her own path. And we even, when way back when in the Doll's House, when we were talking about Rose's ending, at that point where Rose gets to sort of, like, work through her trauma and come out the other end of it and gets a positive ending, even though that's sort of maybe negated by what happens in the Kindly Ones. Those two characters have good endings that affirm sort of, like, their agency within the story, whereas I don't feel like Lita does have that moment, you know?
Yeah.
She's kissed on the head like a small child and sent on her way, and it's like she, throughout the books, has never had much agency. She's been sort of, like, wrapped up in other people's storylines, and so I think it's kind of frustrating to see that continue in the finale, knowing that this is the last time we'll probably see her.
Yeah, it is. It does seem a bit strange and unfortunate.
But that is the first three.
That's the first three. Okay, let's turn to the last three issues and the last three in this book. We'll start with Sunday morning, with Hobgadlin and his girlfriend going to the Ren Fair, where his girlfriend is what would you call her? A part of the cast, I guess?
Yeah, I'm so sure there's probably a term that is preferred, but cast sounds right. Like, she's... Okay.
She puts on the costume.
What do they call them at Disney? They're cast members at Disney, aren't they?
They're cast members, yeah.
I don't know if it's the same at Ren Fairs.
Somebody will tell us. And Hobgadlin. So, you know, we like when Hobgadlin turns up. He gets to sit and drink beer, and then he gets a moment in a abandoned barn with Death, who turns up and confirms to him that her brother is dead. And has a conversation with him about his own options, as it were. What did you think of this issue?
I had some thoughts about this issue. I felt like the depiction of the Ren Fair and, like, Hobbs, like, problems with the Ren Fair, and also this sort of, like, nice loop of someone being like, oh, there was, like, a bookbinder who had the same name as you, maybe you're distantly related. And that was a kind of, like, nice little moment of this sort of, like... Yes. This history coming back around, and obviously the character of Hobgadlin is mostly a fun and cheery one throughout the books, and, like, yeah, we've said he's kind of one of our favourites when he turns up. But this issue wants to explore something key, and I'm not sure if it does a very good job of it.
Would that be the issue of his history for a period of time as a slaver? And his relationship with a black American woman.
Yes. So obviously we've had, like, it's in the first time we meet Hobgadlin, there's a scene with Dream where Dream says, maybe don't be a slaver.
Yes.
Yeah. The implication being that Hobgadlin has already started working in the slave trade. And here we get, it's an interesting idea of a white person expressing white guilt for something that happened historically.
Yes.
But also knowing that this character not only has
a sort of contemporaneous guilt for history, but also was very much a part of that history, is a sort of interesting twist on the story, but quite a hard one to wrap your head around, I think. And he sort of goes off talking about the slave trade and how horrible it was, and, you know, talking about the hindsight he has brought to it after acknowledging that it was a despicable thing to do. And he's expressing this to his black girlfriend, and she is sort of, I don't know, I'm not sure how I feel about her character and the way she reacts to him. You know, we've mentioned how Richard Madoc kind of gets in, is kind of absolved at the end of...
He gets a pass, yeah.
Yeah, and here it feels like Hobgadlin maybe gets a pass too.
But the pass he's been given is by his girlfriend, who assumes he's got a sort of contemporary white guilt. She doesn't realise that he's talking about actual history,
actual
facts,
actions that he took part in.
That he was involved with. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. She's sort of not given the full story, which maybe would have changed how she is written. She's also a black character written by a white male, so there's another like layer there about whether this is like unconsciously or consciously an absolution of the problematic black characters that we've seen in the books already by Neil Gaiman. There's another level to it there. I feel, again, this is one of those storylines that would have maybe be, would be maybe hopefully framed differently now.
Yes.
And maybe we'd see Gwen being given a little bit more of an edge, whereas here she's sort of...
She's a sunny, cheerful personality she's depicted as, isn't she?
Yes, and she, her conversations with him, I mean, you know, for a basic fact, what Hobgadlin is doing here is mansplaining, is white mansplaining the slave trade to a black woman who's like, yeah, I know. And again, there's like, yeah, that sort of weirdness of like, this is not something he's learned about, this is something he participated in, which makes that sort of lecture a little bit more problematic. But yeah, I feel like she's sort of maybe very familiar with this type of white guilt, and so she sort of is like shrugging it off in a way that maybe nowadays we would expect a little bit more of a like critique that doesn't come from a white male perspective, maybe. I don't know, I wouldn't really want to like speak as a white person to an expectation, but it feels like he gets a hug at the end of it, and it feels like, yeah, I don't... I mean, maybe it's just that she doesn't have the full story, so I feel like she's not able to make an accurate
And she's getting ready for her Ren Faire performance, and she's going off, and she's clearly, this is something she enjoys doing and she's looking forward to it, but it does feel a little bit like he's granted some form of absolution without her having the full context of what he's talking about. As you say, we are probably not qualified to comment in more detail, but it did felt uncomfortable, felt jarring, felt a bit strange when, you know, particularly in 2020 when Black Lives Matter, and we've seen slavers' statues quite rightly being torn down and thrown into harbours and whatever. It felt like a jarring note in this comic book, didn't it?
It did, and it is followed up quite quickly with another jarring note, which is another little throwaway line where Gwen comments that when she first met Hob, or rather Hob mentions that one of his friends is dead. I think he's actually referring to Dream at that point. And Gwen replies, when I first met you, I thought you might be gay because so many of your friends were dead. And so this is obviously like a reference to, at this point, the ongoing HIV/AIDS crisis. And we've obviously seen mentions of that previously in The Sandman, and obviously something that was very like of the time, shall we say. It was still ongoing at this point in the early 90s and still very fresh. And everyone was very aware of it. So it makes sense as to why there's so many references to it in The Sandman, as to when The Sandman was written. But this line in particular feels unnecessary and kind of heartless. I don't know how you felt about it. It's sort of throwaway and you could actually miss it. But for me, it felt like, you know, this book, The Sandman has sort of up and downs representing the queer community, and this, as the kind of like last mention we'll get, felt a little bit like crass, shall we say.
Yeah. I didn't like the throwaway line. It did stand out to me on my rereading this time. Neil Gaiman had already sort of addressed the AIDS epidemic with the issue of Chantal and Zelda, and this throwaway line in this issue, well, it just felt like a dud note. It felt like he'd struck a dud note to me.
Yeah. And even when, you know, the text itself is like, that's not very funny, and then Gwen is like, no, it's not very funny. And it's like, yeah, but you still wrote it. So, you know, you can't lampshade everything. So I don't know, that's sort of like, there's like two pages where that is sort of the main focus of the story. And it felt like that was the, although the interaction with Death is quite nice.
So obviously Death turns up, and as ever, she is her usual engaging personality, and it's a good moment.
Yeah.
And there's a beautiful scene of where he has a dream of him and Morpheus and Destruction walking on a beach with a beautiful sunset. That's lovely.
That is
nice. But there were a couple of jarring moments in this issue which stood out to me. It used to be one of my favourite issues, but on this reread, I'm still sticking, like you, I think, to Emperor Norton the First and Three Octobers and a January, if I've got the name right.
Yeah, I think we just can't, you know, can't ignore and can't move over those kind of references nowadays, and we shouldn't do so. So it's sort of the whole focus of that issue stops being about the conversation with Death and starts being about those two pages when we reread these things.
What about the penultimate issue, Exiles, with art by John J. Muth? Another one of the sort of soft places interludes, very similar to the story soft places that I think turned up in Fables and Reflections.
Yes. What a curious choice to make this the penultimate issue of the run. We haven't mentioned the art style, but the art style for the previous four. Yeah, it's the same Michael artist Zulu, for the previous four, isn't it? And that is in itself a quite different art style than we've seen before. It's sort of more, it's softer and more sort of like sketchy, which gives them like a distinct energy. And then it comes in here with this like big Asian ink style.
Yes.
Which I believe we're being told a sort of story in the Chinese Empire. So yeah, it gets these sort of very graphic, broad brush strokes of art style with these like little interludes of colour panels and the text.
It's a lot of black and white. With occasional splashes of
black and
colour.
Lots of words.
Yes, lots of words. A character lost in a desert again in one of the so-called soft places where you can break through into the dream, it would seem. And he encounters the two different versions of dream. So he encounters Morpheus and then he encounters, at the end of the story, Daniel. And I've read it in this reread and, you know, in the last few days, I've read it twice, trying to figure out what this story was trying to tell us and why he'd put this in at this stage in the run. And I still can't figure it out.
I think he just wanted another cat at the end.
It's a cat story, yes. There's a great cat. Walks the Night Alone is the name of the kitten.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose I did like the fact that when Dream Morpheus is with the cat, he almost seems to be reverting to his feline form for a brief panel, and then he's back to classic black and white Dream for the main character. But yeah, okay, I didn't know. I was lost with this one. I was lost in the soft places myself and wasn't quite sure which way we were going or what it was trying to tell me. There's clearly something about the death of a son and the fact that, you know, he's dealing with the death of Orpheus.
I felt like in the past we've talked about the other soft places dream, like dream stories, and I think we've mentioned that like one of the good things I think in The Sandman is how good Neil Gaiman is at capturing that sort of like dream logic and dream narratives that occur. So like my favorite bit in this one is when he comes across like a crane machine, a claw machine,
a funfair claw machine,
and has to pick up the bridge, and then the bridge is something he walks across, and it's like a very good like little sequence of panels.
And it must be in a dream because you can never pick up anything with those claws.
Exactly.
And he does it first time.
So I felt like this is maybe just another chance for Neil Gaiman to flex those sort of like dream writing muscles and give us a little more hint of the dreaming and a little bit more an implication maybe that the world, the dream world has like not ended with the end of the Sandman stories, but beyond that, I wasn't really... This is not, like, a standout to me, and I'd kind of forgotten about it, and...
then you remembered why you'd forgotten about it.
Yeah, and it feels a little bit like lost in this issue, which up until this point has been very driven to like look at the death of Dream.
At the funeral, look at the mourning, look at the mourners. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to the very last issue of Sandman, issue 75, The Tempest. Charles Vest takes over on art. This is Dream's last encounter with William Shakespeare, and it's the second part of their contract, the second play he was going to deliver him. A line from The Tempest itself, I believe: "We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep." Very appropriate. What did you make of this one?
I didn't mind it. I liked the Tempest moments. I don't know the Tempest particularly well. Like, it's not a Shakespeare that I was ever forced to study or watch, so it's not stuck in my brain in the way that like Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet, and A Winter's Tale are.
Summer Night's Dream.
And so, yeah, I like those little moments, like indications of what of the Tempest and the like way the art style changes. Like the first panel is this like really beautiful image of the ship at the sea, and there's like other moments where we see the characters come in and out, and the sort of play plays out during this issue. So I love those moments. I guess Neil Gaiman, like a lot of writers, is obsessed with Shakespeare.
Yes.
And the elusiveness of Shakespeare's life. So we'll get lots of hints here about like the Dark Lady and like the King,
his dead son,
and like
Hammett.
Guy Fawkes and like Judith and like all of that stuff,
play,
which
yeah,
it's all in that sort of world of like, but who was Shakespeare kind of vibe.
Where did he get these stories from?
Why do we remember these stories and not anybody else's? Yeah. And I think it's good in that sense, but I am also a bit tired of that idea. So I just like rereading this, I wasn't super like interested in it, and the moments with like Dream and the moments of the like Tempest play were like the most interesting to me personally.
Clearly he's interested in the idea of where people get their stories and their ideas from, and then the sort of, to some extent, the burden of writing, you know, having to come up with a new story, having to arrange words in a new order. There's also some weird stuff about patronage in there, which we talked about way back in Dream Country when this first came up, the first half of the bargain. I liked the two conversations he has with Dream when Shakespeare's asleep, particularly like when they travelled to the heart of the Dream Inn, to his throne room. And you might remember, you might know what I'm going to say next about a certain character that turns up. It would appear that in Shakespeare's time, it wasn't Merv Pumpkinhead, it was Merv Turniphead.
I did wonder about that, and I thought that was very funny.
That is a funny little joke. But also, we get a moment between the two of them where Shakespeare is trying to ask him why he commissioned these plays, what he wanted, particularly of The Tempest. And Dream refers to the play and says, "I wanted a king who drowns his books and breaks his staff and leaves his kingdom." So even back then, you get this idea, or I do now, that Dream was struggling with the weight of his responsibilities and wanted to, in fiction at least, explore ways, characters who might leave it behind and move on. It's my retirement plan analogy again.
I mean, I think you're right, because we've talked before about how at every decision that seems to be made, every action that leads him to the path that happens in The Kindly Ones, it seems to be that he is aware of what's happening. You know, he knows the decisions he makes, say, for example, in Brief Lives, will lead to The Kindly Ones. And so, yeah, this is another indication that that has not just happened since he was trapped in a bubble, but has actually been happening for him for quite a while. So, yeah, your retirement theory is, I think, apt. I would also say that maybe Dream has just always been a mopey bastard. And, like, actually what we see here is not him, like, over a series of centuries deciding that he wants to leave or that he's fed up, but having always been fed up with being the Lord of Dreams, having always had terrible relationships with women, having always had these thoughts about leaving, about running away, about his responsibilities, about not liking his responsibilities, but still having to do his responsibilities. And maybe that's just who he's always been. So what we perceive as like a sort of 5-year period in which he expresses these things finally is actually just, you know, the difference here, the change that he makes here is that he actually goes through with it. Like, I don't know, it kind of makes sense as to why Death is so like fed up all the time. Maybe an indication that she knows this stuff. She's heard him say this stuff before.
She's seen him doing it, yes. You've been making these plans all the time, even though you didn't let yourself know what you were doing.
Yeah. I mean, an indication that, like, you know, we've talked about how desire is portrayed, for example, that, like, desire seems to be, like, innately this sort of calculating and, like, nefarious character. And maybe, again, that's just desire's whole vibe and has been the whole time, you know? They've been trying to kill their brother since at least Orpheus's, you know, times, like, been trying to kill their brother this whole time. So maybe the only member of the family who actually makes a change is Destruction. But then again, maybe that was whole Destruction's whole thing was just walking away the whole time. So, I don't know, I kind of think, yeah, I'm just content to believe that Dream is just a mopey bastard the whole time.
He's always been.
He's always been a mopey bastard. It's not just been these five years gone.
Exactly. He's always been like this, and he's always been thinking about the way out. And maybe events conspired to actually allow him the opportunity to put the plan into action.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts about the last volume of The Sandman, The Wake, at all, from your notes or anything else?
I think after this reread, it feels a little bit anticlimactic.
Yeah.
I think the first 3 issues, and maybe the Hobgadlin issue as well, feel like the true ending. You know, if it ended with the Hobgadlin issue, would it maybe feel differently?
Well, if I was writing this for the screen, I think I would end with that scene of Hobgadlin, Morpheus and Destruction walking along the beach into the sunset. I mean, you know, there's a cliche if ever there was one, but I would probably end it there and I wouldn't bother with Exiles or The Tempest. Interestingly, I read that Neil Gaiman had wanted to put The Tempest in earlier in the run, but couldn't get it to fit in, or the artwork was taking, because I think it's double-sized, that issue, and the artwork was taking Charles Vest longer, so he left it to right at the end. But I think you're probably right. The anti-climax sort of comes from those last 2 issues. If it had finished after Sunday morning, and perhaps if he'd left out a couple of jarring moments that we didn't like in that issue, then it would have seemed more of an ending, perhaps.
Yeah, or even if there were, like, maybe 2 more other random stories, a la Fables and Reflections, right? Like, 2 more of these stories that don't quite connect, but maybe give us a little bit more about Daniel, who we haven't really had a chance to, like, get to know, and we aren't given the chance to get to know, but maybe that would have been the sort of, like, send-off. I don't know. Yeah, I don't feel like it's the best ending for The Sandman, but it does feel like an appropriate ending for The Sandman, especially on this reread, where it's like, it's not perfect, but it is an ending.
Well, that seems like a perfect moment for us to sit back and reflect that we've done it. We have got through our reread of all of Neil Gaiman's The Sandman. We have, as our listeners know, found a lot of problems along the way with our reread. That seems to be the handful of dust modus operandi.
Always critique.
Always critique. I put this line from the TV show Lovecraft Country that's on at the moment, where one of the characters is talking about the John Carter of Mars books by Edgar Rice Burroughs, and the fact that John Carter starts out life as a Confederate soldier. And because the character reading the book in the TV series and the woman talking to him about him are both black Americans, she says that's a real problem, reading a book about a man who fought for slavery. And his reply is, stories are like people. Loving them doesn't make them perfect. You just try to cherish them and overlook their flaws. So, do we still cherish this series, having reread it now all in one go?
Yeah, it feels like a big question.
It is a big question. I mean, I would say I still think it's fantastic. I just think, you know, we found all these problems along the way, and they are flaws in the story, and they are flaws from, I suppose, 30 years on, 2020 vision, as we've talked about before.
Yeah, I think The Sandman, for me as a whole, really represents like a very particular point in my life. Like, I read it as a teenager, and I read a lot of comic books as a teenager that feel very similar, but also the ones I wouldn't really necessarily want to go back and reread. And I think, thinking about The Sandman, you know, early on we were talking and I was like, I'm excited to get to Brief Lives. We'd already discussed A Game of You on Mega City Book Club, and so I was excited to revisit that. But, you know, like, I was excited to get to Brief Lives. Like, it's the one I reread the most. It's my favourite collection, and it was nice to have that still be my favourite, you know, still, like, really hold up well. And in the reread, to be like, yes, there's a, you know, there are lots of reasons why this is my favourite, and it makes sense as to why this is the one I remember the most. And so, yeah, I can't really separate The Sandman from that, like, importance it had for me reading it for the first time. And I still think it's a great comic book. Like, it's a great story. I still think Neil Gaiman is, like, an incredible writer. I would probably have used to have said he was my favourite writer, or one of my favourite writers. I'm not sure if that's true now, just because I read a lot more things and a lot more different things. And it's like, I still think he's an incredible writer. But I'm not, you know, desperate to read the next thing, or desperate to read everything he's ever written, as I maybe was when I was a teenager, having just finished, like, Coraline and Sandman, and was like, must read American Gods cover to cover right now.
And must go and sit in Ely Cathedral and listen to him speak, and then come back at midnight or whatever it was to get him to sign issue one of the Sandman annual Delirium sketch or Delirium drawing. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, as you say, very important book to you at the time, still an important book, still...
I mean, how do you feel, like, about having read it when it was first coming out and then having reread it over the years, having given it to both me and Tom, my brother, to read? Should clarify who Tom is.
So I still think it's great comics. I still think, you know, reading it at the time, there was nothing like it. And this rich tapestry of fantasy, of mythology, of stories upon stories, was just incredible stuff. And when I look back, because, you know, I had a great time with comics in the 1980s, reading things like Halo Jones, which you and I have talked about, reading Watchmen, reading Dark Knight Returns, all these things as they came out. Looking back on them, as you know, I've got more problems now about Dark Knight Returns. I've got more problems now about Watchmen. We've discovered problems with The Sandman as we've gone along, but I still rate it. I still think it's one of the greatest comic book achievements in 75 issues. So I'm still recommending it to people. I would still pass it on to people, but I would probably give them some of our content notes along the way, or refer them to our content notes for each trade. Would you still pass the books to somebody?
Yeah, I think I would. And I have done in the past. I think we've talked about
this. Yes. Game of You particularly, you've handed to people.
Game of You I've handed to people. Dream Country I've handed to people. And I think now I've spoken to people. I'm trying to think. I definitely spoke to someone really recently about it, like a year ago. And I think I said the same. And I think now I think I'd even stick to my guns a little bit more and not just say start with Game of You. I'd say Game of You, Brief Lives, Fables and Recollections, Dream Country, Kindly Ones. Great. You don't have to read it all. Yes. You know, maybe you don't have to read it all, actually. You don't have to read it in order. I think, actually, there's a lot you could get from just reading, like, bits and pieces thereabouts. And maybe as a quick way to get sort of, like, into comic books, it's some of those individual issues are really good ways of, like, hooking people into, like, comic books. And I remember the person I gave Dream Country to specifically because they hadn't read any comic books at that point, and I was like, I think you'll really like them. But there was a very, you know, there was still that kind of like expectation of what a comic book is, or like superhero comic books is, and this was a person who I knew like loved fantasy and loved sort of like mythology, and I was like, no, you're gonna love it, like it's pictures, but it's great. Great. Yeah. Pictures. And I think, yeah, some of those issues would really still do that.
So we're still recommending it. We've enjoyed our reread. I've certainly enjoyed our conversations we've had about it, which has made me look at this stuff in a new light. Game of You, possibly still the starter one, you think?
I think so. I mean, we've talked a bit about how that gives you a good intro to, like, the dream logic and who Dream is without having to, like, jump straight in. I do think you could probably read Brief Lives and not necessarily need to know everything as well. So that might be the one I start recommending to people from now on. As it is, and it will remain my favourite.
Yeah, Brief Lives is a high point. Game of You is a high point. I like the kindly ones. And, of course, we love the story of Emperor Norton the First and only in the Fables and Reflections volume. Great stuff. Anything else you wanted to add?
I think it's interesting that you said that when you read The Sandman, there was nothing like it, and how I sort of felt like it was the first big comic book graphic novel, whatever, that really, like, got me excited about things. Like, I think I had read Mouse, I think I had read Watchmen, and then I think I read Sandman, and I read them all sort of about the same time. And out of those, Sandman is the only one I've ever gone back and reread. There were a couple others I think I read at the same time, but... And it was really the one that made me want to, like, go out and find more comic books and, like, find stuff that I liked and stuff that wasn't in your collection, maybe. You know, and I was reading a lot of webcomics at the time as well. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of value to it as a sort of, like, starting point, not only for Neil Gaiman's work, maybe, but, like, as a starting point for comic books in general, as a way of, like, separating them slightly from their, like, superhero background, maybe separating them from their, like, you have to know everything and then everything will get retconned next week kind of baggage that comes with people. I think if they're going to start reading, like, a Marvel or a DC, there's a lot of, like, need to have all the background story, and I think Sandman is a good example of how you can, like, create a story and a huge world with a huge amount of, like, characters and backstory and not have it weigh it down as much. Which I think, you know, I think superhero comic books do that too. I think once you've read a couple, you get the skill at, like, recognizing characters when they pop back up, or, like, recognizing that you're supposed to recognize them, if that makes sense. Like that, you know, we've talked about the
DC callbacks.
The people in The Sandman where I'm like, I don't know who this is, but I think I'm supposed to know who this is. So I think this is a reference. And then you confirm to me that it is, in fact, a reference. I think that's a sort of, like, comic book skill that you need to pick up when you start reading them. Otherwise you get very lost in the, like, who is this man with the claws who's just walked in? He seems important and Canadian. I don't know who he is. So yeah, I think it's a good example of, like, how, like, comic books are their best, and how, like, maybe a good entry point for someone who's looking to, like, get to grips with reading comic books as well.
Fantastic stuff. That has been the first 10 volumes, or the 10 volumes of The Sandman. Housekeeping notes, we are carrying on. We're going to take a quick break, so we might be off for a week or two, and then we hope to be back possibly in a fortnight with the first Death miniseries, Death, The High Cost of Living. At the moment, we're planning on covering both of the Death miniseries. We've talked about doing Jill Thompson's Little Endless and her sort of manga-inspired At Death's Door, which I think we'll be doing as well. The Dream Hunters, I'm quite looking forward to talking about. Less so, perhaps, for Endless Nights. And then we're also obviously going to cover The Overture at some point, is our plan, I think. Any others that we want to add in at this moment that you can think of offhand?
I don't think so. We've mentioned a bit in the past that the Dead Boy Detective's got a spin-off, and I think Thessaly got a spin-off as well, but not super. We may just, like, mention them a little bit, but I don't think we're going to, like, do a deep reread of those.
Okay. But if anybody has any suggestions for other tales from the Dream Inn that they'd like us to cover, then please get in touch. mcbcpodcast@gmail.com is in the show notes. Cool. Done it.
Yeah, it feels like it went quickly. I don't know.
Thank you to everybody for listening to our reread. We hope you've enjoyed your own reread, and we hope you found something of interest in our discussions.
Until we come back to cover Death, The High Cost of Living, thank you for listening. I'm Jenny.
And I'm Eamon.